Now, a press release was issued by the Department of Health yesterday afternoon. I'm not particularly sure that anybody was expecting it, but what it did state was the announcement that contact tracing in primary schools and creches, specifically for children under 12 who are close contacts of a confirmed COVID case but who are asymptomatic, will cease from this Monday. Joined on the line now to discuss this by President of the INTO, Joe McKeown. Joe, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Ciara. I'm glad to be able to talk to your listeners.
We're delighted to have you here. I think this announcement took most people by surprise, but particularly that it's scheduled to begin on Monday.
Yes, I think that we'll all be very happy when we get to the stage where children can go to school and have uninterrupted schooling. But I think our concerns are, first of all, that this decision was based on evidence that is incomplete in relation to schools reopening. But also that making the announcement yesterday at a time when, you know, principals basically are only finding out today exactly what's involved, and even the frequently asked questions hasn't yet issued from the department with answers to that. So we feel quite strongly that come Monday morning, neither parents nor schools will be prepared for what's coming next. And on Monday, the schools have been told that from Monday, if there's a COVID case in your school, you don't tell anyone. You don't contact the HSE, you don't tell parents, you simply, if a child has symptoms, you send that child home and you do nothing else. And so therefore, from Monday, there will be no tracing or tracking of the spread of COVID in schools, whether it's increasing or decreasing or staying the same. And we think that's a worrying development.
Well, it would all be well and good, Joe, if schools operated in a vacuum, but unfortunately they sit within their communities and there is traffic constantly throughout the day into and out of schools. And we've already heard in recent weeks at one point 12,000 children, primary and secondary, it must come with that caveat, were isolating because they were deemed close contacts. The HSPC released data yesterday that there were 90 cluster outbreaks in schools across the country, the vast majority of those in primary schools, which was in and of itself an increase from 40 the previous week. So from Monday on, we won't have this data. So we won't be able to map how COVID is being transmitted, if at all.
We won't. And I think a lot of parents, as well as schools, will be concerned about that. But another thing that's going to happen on Monday is that this whole system and what we're moving to now depends on schools and parents knowing exactly what the symptoms of COVID are to look out for and what to do. And at the moment, there's confusion about a number of things. So, for example, there's confusion around whether a runny nose or a blocked nose is a symptom of COVID and whether you should keep children home. The department at the moment are saying, yes, you should, and that's in writing. But elements of the HSE are saying, no, you shouldn't. And they need to get onto the same page and have that clear, because I think parents who are heading to work need to know exactly what's expected of them, and they need to know what to look out for, and the schools need to know what to say. And we don't want parents and teachers arguing over symptoms throughout next week, when really there should be clarity, and that clarity isn't there at the moment. So we think they should just really wait a couple of weeks. On October the 22nd, all restrictions have been lifted for everybody. That will tie in neatly with a midterm break, and that would give us all time to prepare for the next phase and the next return to normal, which is what we all want for the people in our schools.
Would it be fair to say, Joe, that an awful lot of your members were only kind of now hitting their stride with the restrictions or the changes to restrictions and regulations that were introduced at the advent of the new school term? We're only on the 23rd of September. We have a new change coming down on whatever date Monday is. It escapes me. It all feels very rushed.
Yes. And I think what principals would feel particularly is that it is quite clear the HSE weren't ready to support schools when schools reopened. Principals have spent a lot of time doing a lot of the contact tracing themselves. There were long delays in getting through to the public health. We don't have complete data for any full week just yet. And so we feel that this is a really rushed decision and one that schools aren't prepared for and that parents aren't prepared for either. And we feel it's been taken far too soon and far too quickly.
The government line, as distinct from that which may issue from the HSE or NEFID, seems to be, look, it's far from ideal to have 12,000 children isolating at any given time. That has negative impacts on their education and on their social development. So this might be a better option when the vast majority of those children will stay well. I think everybody would have a lot of sympathy with that line, but there's an awful lot of wooliness there.
Yeah, I think you're right. But I think the thing is, this time next week, we won't know how many children are missing school because of COVID, because it won't be tracked. And, you know, for example, we don't know what's going to happen if word gets out through parents' WhatsApp groups, for example, that there's a COVID case in a class or in a school. How many parents will take it upon themselves not to send their child into school? The school won't be communicating. It will spread through the rumour mill, and there'll be no evidence to show how many children are missing school due to COVID. At least last week, we knew the number, and we knew who they were, and we knew why they were out. That information is all going to be lost as and from next Monday, and I don't think we're ready for that.
Could schools, in theory, not continue to collect that data for their own information?
No, schools cannot collect data like that without a legal purpose, that is a contravention of GDPR regulations. We have to be authorised to collect information, and we can only collect the information that we require and is required by law. And clearly the government is, and we have a clear instruction from the HSE, that schools next week, when we hear that there's a COVID case, schools are to do nothing. Now, there's a lot of principals will feel their life will get a lot easier because they don't have to go and do the tracking and tracing and risk assessments. But I think an awful lot of them are wondering, is it going to keep the schools any safer? And I think that's a big concern for us all.
Joe McKeown, President of the Irish National Teachers Organisation, thank you indeed for joining us. Is your child in primary school or indeed in creche? Because this will also apply to smaller children, any child under the age of 12. What do you think about this? Is it premature? Is it happening right on time? 0833 97 97 97.
Later on this afternoon, we are going to be speaking with Una Ring, the co-founder of Stalking Ireland. She has quite a story to share with our listeners. But almost 70% of female TDs and senators who did respond to a survey have been verbally harassed on the street. This is a poll of 33 female members of the Oireachtas, and it just outlines how many people do not feel safe walking alone at night. Patricia, you yourself, did you partake in the survey?
I did partake in the survey, Ciara, I did.
And tell me, what's your experience?
I haven't been verbally abused, but I do certainly have a fear, particularly in areas that wouldn't be well lit or areas that wouldn't be well policed. I certainly would. And also, I get to lose most days coming here to Leinster House, and I certainly would have experienced a fear factor on that.
Now, I myself know people who would say the same about certain public transport, but in terms of your role as a politician and a representative of Kildare South, how does that impact your day-to-day, I guess, handling of these sort of situations?
Well, I suppose you're always aware that you're a politician, and you can be, I suppose, in some formats given abuse. But, I mean, you go into this job expecting people to be controversial to what you do, but you certainly need to feel safe, and you don't need to be abused verbally all of the time. And on occasions, you would be.
You're one of a minority in terms of female representatives of this country. Do you think these sort of experiences, and yourself and your colleagues coming out and speaking about them, will potentially deter other women from coming forward and running for politics? Because it's already a tough game, and when you hear about all the extras, it probably would turn people off.
Yeah, there's a possibility, Ciara, that will happen. We'd like to think it won't. And in Sinn Féin, we've always been highlighting for a community-based policing model, which makes people more safe in their own structures and in their own communities. And when you're on the ground as a politician, you are working within your own structure and communities. So I think if we had that, we would feel safer as well.
Patricia, in your personal opinion, what can we do to tackle this problem?
I think we need to have more Garda presence. I think men also fear in some areas, and I think men equally do get abused. They may not get the same amount as women, but there certainly is a certain cohort of men that do get abused. And I think even if we look at various different areas where people have been spoken to rudely or in an aggressive manner, they're both male and female. It may happen more in the female world. But I think we need more Garda visibility, and we need more community Garda and more investment in the community policing model, Ciara.
So in terms of men's behaviour when it does happen, as you point out, to both genders, but would say when it happens, a female is being verbally harassed by a male. In that situation, what's there to be done, Patricia?
There's definitely a need for it to be reported and a need for it to be dealt with in a, I suppose, in a judicial sense if it's brought to court. And we certainly need to highlight more the issues that women are experiencing around abuse.
OK, and just to let our listeners know some more information from that survey of the 33 female politicians that did respond to it, 5 admitted they had been attacked, 67% have been verbally harassed, 82% have received unwanted attention from a stranger, and 7 in 10 female representatives say they do not feel safe walking home alone at night, while 3 in 10 say they would never risk it. Obviously, many issues there. Kildare South representative for Sinn Féin, Patricia Ryan, joining me. So thank you very much, Patricia.
Thank you, Ciara. Thank you for your time.
And that was, of course, Kildare Focus producer Ciara Noble. The Central Bank and the Department of Finance want to create a new fund to cushion the blow should an insurance company fail. That hasn't been met with round applause. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by Peter Boland. He's Director of the Alliance for Insurance Reform. Peter, you're welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Ciara.
I saw Charlie Weston, personal finance editor in the Irish Independent, writing on this matter, saying that there are already 7 levies by that name or any other on insurance of pretty much all kinds in Ireland. Where is this proposal for an effective 8th coming from?
Yeah, it couldn't happen at a worse time, Ciara, given the extent to which policyholders are struggling with insurance costs. But to give you an example, say on motor, when you buy your motor premium, there's a 3% stamp duty on it, as it's called, that it was initially to pay back for the collapse of the PMPA in 1983, but it's been going ever since.
Surely that's been well paid at this point.
Oh, my God, it has. Yeah, they just changed the name to a stamp duty. There's been a 2% insurance compensation fund levy since 2012. To cover Quinn Insurance and that collapse. There's been a 2% motor insurer's insolvency fund, which was triggered by Setanta and is intended to fill in for future collapses. And that's an important point. I'll get back to that in a second. There's an additional 3% levy to cover the Motor Insurers Bureau of Ireland, which covers incidents where there's an uninsured driver or somebody drives off. And then there's a €1 stamp duty on every policy as well. So there's no room in there for extra. That's 10% and a little bit extra. There's no room in there for additional levies. Now, what we suspect they're talking about here, and this came as something of a surprise to everybody, the Department of Finance and the Central Bank said that they'd issued a public consultation. Essentially, what they've done is they've put it up in a corner of their website, and nobody knew about it until Niall Brady in the Sunday Times and then Charlie Weston in the Independent dug it up over the weekend. And from what we can figure about it, what they're talking about doing is taking those levies and extending them over to other types of insurance, which would be home insurance and critically liability insurance, which is the one that we've spoken about so many times. It's the one that is already unaffordable for a lot of small businesses and voluntary and community groups. So it would be of enormous concern if we thought that they were going to pile it on in an area that's already unaffordable. Now, what makes it all the more worrying from our perspective is that, firstly, it's premature because we're waiting to see the detail of proposals from the European Commission on this very area, because they're talking about a European-wide regime. And secondly, to a certain extent, it's unnecessary now because since the start of 2016, there's been a European-wide supervisory framework called Solvency II, which is far more onerous than the previous frameworks were. And so the chances of an insurer going belly up have been dramatically reduced since the start of 2016. And we feel very concerned about this. To be honest, we feel very frustrated by it because right now, there are, as we've talked about before, 37 sectors that either cannot get insurance or are down to their last broker. And to be honest, the Department of Finance and the Central Bank would be better served getting additional competition into the market rather than considering levies for theoretical events that may not happen.
It's also manifestly unfair and administratively very untidy, because fair enough, I can see why you would need funding from insurance to fund the Motor Insurers Bureau. It has to get its money from somewhere. But the other three, it seems that there is no justification at all for their continued existence, particularly post 2016, Peter, as you outlined, with that new the EU framework introduced at that point. So what we potentially are going to see is those four levies, which have nothing to do with home or liability insurance, picked up, moved over and plopped down for a reason which is verging on being spurious.
100%. And as we understand it, there is no facility in Irish law for those funds to be ring-fenced. So it doesn't matter what the name on the levy is. It essentially goes into the central funds and exchequer. And typically, we suspect, just disappears without trace. Yeah. So it's a tax by another name.
And the levies were imposed for very specific reasons, which I think all of us who might remember back that far can understand. I know that the collapse of PNPA sent shockwaves really throughout Irish society at the time, because it was unprecedented. We all remember Quinn. We all remember Setanta. But the levies were imposed and we were all given to believe that, you know, for a short period of time. And yet here we are in some cases 30 odd years later and they're still there. They're never going to be removed, are they?
No. They need their names to be changed. They're not compensation funds, although it has to be said that the Quinn one is scheduled to run till 2037. So we'll be paying the price of that collapse for some time to come. But like I say, they don't go into central funds, I beg your pardon, into specific funds. They go into central funding. And they disappear without trace.
Should they go into specific funds, Peter? Would that make their imposition more palatable?
Well, it certainly make it an awful lot easier to track them and figure out the benefit of them. But like, to be honest with you, Ciara, the fact that we're spending time and energy discussing this is incredibly frustrating from our point of view, because the big issue right now is, you will have seen, for example, Squirrel Scramble, the outdoor adventure facility close to you in Wicklow, which closed down over the weekend. And we have many more examples of places that are on the verge of closing down because they cannot get cover or they can't get it at an affordable price. And that's the big issue right now. And that's what government should be spending their time on, not the distraction of some hypothetical collapse, which is less and less likely because of Solvency II.
Peter Boland, Director of the Alliance for Insurance Reform, thank you as always for your time. Now, a new public consultation and a survey conducted by the Health Information and Quality Authority, along with the Department of Health and the HSE, has found the overwhelming majority of us are happy for information about our health to be collected, but that consent comes with some caveats, particularly as they pertain to security. Joined on the line now to discuss this by Rachel Flynn, Director of Health and Information Standards at HICWA. Rachel, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much, Ciara.
I suppose it makes sense that the vast majority of the 1,300 respondents were satisfied for information about their health to be collected, because in order for us to be treated, information has to exist and be stored in some way.
Exactly. So I suppose maybe just go back to why we did this in the first place. We very much wanted to see what were the public's attitudes around the sharing of information. You're correct in saying that if we want an integrated system, so for GPs to talk to pharmacists and pharmacists to talk to hospitals and hospitals to talk to public health nurses, we need robust health information systems. And so we went out to the public and we surveyed over 1,200 people, asking them about their opinions about this. As you've rightly said, the vast majority are extremely comfortable with this information being shared for direct care purposes. And the vast majority of the public are also happy for it to be shared for secondary purposes, such as health service management or quality improvement. But they have identified, we've identified through the survey and through focus groups, we conducted focus groups with 85 people, that they have to be assured that there are safeguards around this data. The data is kept secure, and you know, they have a right, they have their rights in terms of confidentiality and privacy around this data as well.
I would imagine, Rachel, that, that those feelings were thrown into very sharp focus with the advent of the cyber attack on the HSE, which in and of itself underscored the need for security of data.
Yeah, absolutely. So the cyber attack had a huge and detrimental effect on the public and patients and people using health services. So we've seen cancellation of operations, which impact on waiting lists. We saw all healthcare, health and social care systems reverting back to paper, which slowed down the health system considerably. So the it's so important that I suppose we invest in the security of our health information, but not only do we invest in it, that we're proactive about looking for cyber threats all the time in terms of health and social care, and also that we have the right staff in place with the right skills in this area, because it is a specialised area within the health and social care sector.
Would that also require, Rachel, dependent on the type of record, if it's text records only, that they be stored in a particular manner or way or piece of software? Because we do have a situation, even before the cyber attack on the HSE, where dependent upon your health concerns and considerations, quite a lot of your records could be on paper, others could be in Building Y on that particular software system, others in Building Z on a completely different software system.
Yeah, so if you had to compare us with other countries in Europe and throughout the world, we are not, we do not have really good information systems in our healthcare system. So we have, most GPs in this country would have a computerized system, but the problem is that they don't talk to each other. The whole idea with Sláintecare is to implement national solutions like electronic health records, patient summary records, and e-prescribing. And so if you are to implement these systems, you need to make sure that, A, the public are comfortable with this, and that's one of the reasons that we went out to the system. But also, if you want to modernise the health system and make it really efficient and effective, you need computer systems to allow you to do that, to allow your GP to communicate with the hospital and so on.
Those kinds of systems, Rachel, I would imagine would be able to satisfy the desire of 86% of respondents to the study, who would like to be able to have independent access to their own digital records via a national patient portal. That would be enormously desirable for a lot of people.
Absolutely. And what we've seen from other countries, that they have put these portals in place and they have allowed members of the public to access their own information, which, you know, is a right, you know, in terms of the public rights. So again, it's about making sure that we put the proper infrastructure in place. And that is one of the reasons why we did this survey, just to see exactly what are people's thoughts on this. And again, we have seen through the survey that people want to be more involved in their care. They want to have, they want to know who's accessing their information, for what purpose. You know, they have no, they have, they're quite happy for it to be shared, but they need to be informed of that. And then in terms of a patient portal, to be able to go in and see what information at a high level is recorded about them. You know, and I think, you know, other countries have put that in place. And again, the public are quite satisfied with that approach.
I know that, that HICWA conducted this study in partnership with the Department of Health and the HSE. How then will this information by you be used by all three organisations, the results of this survey?
Okay, so the whole idea of this was to do a temperature check, see what the Irish public thought. So we've got that information now. One of the key things we're missing in Ireland is legislation around this, clear legislation which sets out what can be shared in terms of health information and what cannot be shared. So this, the findings of the survey will feed into that process of the development of legislation, which is the Department of Health's role. In terms of our role in HICWA, what we're hoping to do is to do a project on patient portals. So look at how other countries have implemented them, how they involved the public in their design and development, and look at how they should be structured. So again, that piece of work will follow on. We're also doing a piece of work where we're defining, you know, a consent model for the sharing of health information in Ireland. So developing definitions of what we mean by the what we might mean by health information. Do we mean information in a chart? Is it on a computer system? And really setting them out in definitions. Mm. And the HSE then are tasked with implementing these large solutions, so electronic health records and patient portals. So they will use this information and they will further engage with the public on these items as they roll out these national solutions.
Rachel Flynn, Director of Health and Information Standards at the Health Information and Quality Authority, HICWA. Thank you indeed for joining us. The Seanad last night began debating a proposed new law to institute a specific criminal offence of stalking. At present, there's no standalone crime of stalking and cases are taken under harassment legislation. But campaigners say such incidents go far beyond harassment, and the bill, which has been tabled by Fianna Fáil Senator Lisa Chambers, proposes a maximum jail term of 10 years. I spoke of campaigners. I'm joined on the line by one of them, Una Ring, co-founder of stalking.ie. Una, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Delighted to do so. You and co-founder Eve McDowell have been campaigning for some time to get society as a whole to recognise stalking as an individual and specific offence. It's mm-hmm. taken quite a lot of time for us to come around to that. We're almost there.
Yeah, thankfully. Well, I suppose it hasn't taken, I suppose, that long in as much as like my perpetrator was only jailed in February of this year, and Lisa Chambers only contacted us in March. So we've actually only been at this for about 6 months, which in Seanad terms, I suppose, in Oireachtas terms, is
lightning quick.
lightning quick. And it was debated in the Seanad last night. It's going to the committee stage next Tuesday, which is stage three. There's five stages, and the whole process then, if all goes according to plan, the whole process then will have to be repeated in the Dáil from start to finish, the five steps again. But we're very, very hopeful. Like, there was a fierce, we were able to watch the debate live last night, which was absolutely brilliant. But there's fierce cross-party support. Everybody seems to be in favour of it, you know. I know the Minister for Justice isn't in favour of it. The Department of Justice think that the law they have for harassment covers it, but it doesn't really. There's a huge difference between harassment and stalking. I suppose the end goal for somebody who's harassing somebody is just to mess with their mind, whereas the end goal for a stalker is either rape or murder. So, like, you really can't compare the two, you know.
And the you know that kind of messing with your head, that gaslighting, that coercive control that can go with harassment is one thing. It's bad enough to have to live with it. Nobody is downplaying or
no,
in any way diminishing
all.
That.
Not
stalking, though, the malice it requires.
Yeah.
The planning. You have to know the ins and outs of someone's day-to-day life. Know what terrifies them. It's that pre-planning. It's that sitting down and saying, I am going to do A, B, C and D to make this woman's life hell. That's, I think, what sets it apart.
Yeah. And absolutely. I mean, when I was a victim of harassment for the first couple of months when it was messaging and phone calls. And that was bad enough because every time, if you can imagine how often your phone will beep during the day, your heart is in your mouth.
Yeah.
With every single beep, because you don't know whether it's him or not. And I had that for 2 months. And then it just completely escalated to what it became. And that's a whole other level of fear. Like, I was tidying up my house at night for so to be presented for the crime scene photograph. I had to seal my letterbox in case he poured petrol through. I was going to get a tattoo with my name and date of birth so that they'd identify my body.
Jesus.
And, like, this is once the stalking behaviour, once it escalated to stalking. So while the harassment was bad and it was frightening and it brought its own anxiety, and I didn't think it could get any worse, it's just, you don't sleep, you don't eat. It's just on your mind 24/7 because you don't know if they're going to turn up at work, you don't know if they're going to turn up at home, you don't know if they're following me in the car. Mm. When you come out of the supermarket, it's just 24/7, and even you can't sleep properly. because you don't know whether they're going to break in. It's just absolutely horrendous. It's horrific.
So you couldn't sleep, you couldn't relax or take a moment's ease or breath because you're constantly in the grip of a fight or flight response. Your body is constantly ready.
Exactly. That's exactly. You're living literally on your nerves for the whole time. You don't get any break. There's no like, well, do you know, when you're, we'd say while I was being harassed by phone, we'll say there was one or two nights where I just turned off my phone. I just turned it off. And I said, you know what, now to hell with them. I'm turning off my phone for an hour or two. I'm going for a walk. And I was able to do that, even though I knew if I turned it back on, there could be missed calls or missed messages from him. But you could get that hour or two peace. But when somebody's creeping around your house and they're following you and you don't know where they are or when they're going to pop up next, you can't switch off from it. And it's absolutely exhausting, as anybody who goes through it will know. It's exhausting.
Una, were the guards supportive of you?
They were absolutely brilliant. They just, from the very, very beginning, and like, it wasn't just one or two of them were very, very good. Each and every one of them I met, because there was one guy that I reported the harassment to. There was two guys came up when his car was spray painted. There was a guy and a woman came up when the house was sprayed. They came up again when the letter was left. There was two other guys came up when the second letter was left. There was detectives came down from Middleton. There was a guy up from Crime Prevention, as I said. He checked out the house. He told me the only thing I needed to do was seal my letterbox in case petrol was poured in. But he said, this was on a Friday evening. He said, you do it the first thing in the morning. You go down at 9 o'clock. You buy six salt. You buy a post box and you seal that letterbox. But they were just absolutely fantastic. But they put me... Like, even though it was a very serious situation, they not made light of it, but they made as light of it as they could, I suppose.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? They were like, well, we look after you now. And they gave me, I had all their mobile numbers. And they said, look, if you hear a noise outside, you ring and we'll be up. And like they said, if it's a cat on a bin, it's a cat on a bin. It doesn't bloody matter. You know, if you're uneasy or you think, he said, even if you think you hear something, give us a call and we'll be straight up. Like, they all would check in. There was two shifts. There was 7 to 7 daytime, 7 to 7 nighttime, and the 7 to 7 nighttime would call in and say, look, we're on call now. Here's my number. Give me a shout if you hear anything. And they'd swap around. They kept in constant contact with me.
That's incredible.
And it's absolutely incredible. Like, they really went above and beyond. And like, after the first letter was left, they did it. They would do a drive-by maybe 3 or 4 times a night. And then once the second letter was left, they'd set up surveillance outside my house, and that was from midnight until 5 a.m. And they just stayed there because they knew he was coming back, and he did. He did. Within 4 days, he was back, and he was arrested with the crowbar, and they opened the duct tape and lock picking set, and you know, it was really, the whole thing was very, very traumatic. But the guards were absolutely brilliant, you know, because even a little thing like they told me one night to leave the blinds up and leave the dogs sleep in the sitting room. And I did that, and I left the dogs sleep in the sitting room. And he came during the night and he left a letter, and the dogs didn't bark, like, so they were up, and the guards were up the next day, and they were like, oh, fire them, you know. But they were very human as well as being protecting me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They were very professional in and like with their I suppose the evidence that they collected, they did that very professionally because they wanted to make sure there was no loophole that he could get out on. Do you know what I mean? So while they were being very human about it, they were actually very, very professional about it. And we got our day in court and we got him prosecuted, you know. And that was due to them and the chain of evidence and the way they were meticulous in everything they did, like.
I know that he's in prison, 7 years in prison with the last two suspended, 5 years probation, a lifelong no contact order, and he's been placed on the sex offenders register. But does it not occur to you every day, like with that little cold pit of fear in the bottom of your stomach, he will get out?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, even like my counsellor was saying, well, look, don't dwell on that. Like, enjoy the time you have that he's in sight. But it's very, very hard not to. Like, I'm still, like, mentally preparing for when he gets out. I'm looking around the house going, what else can I do to keep this man from getting into my home? You know? And it's just, Like, and I will be terrified. And there's no point in saying I won't. I will be terrified when he gets out. And, you know, people are saying here he won't come near you. Like, people said when he was leaving the letters that because he left the letters, like, if he was going to come and attack you, he'd attack you without kind of announcing it. But he did come back down to attack me, you know. So nobody can make you feel
safe,
you know, guaranteed that he's not going to come near me. And I mean, if he could, like, go off to another country, it would be grand. It would be brilliant if he went away. But he can't for 5 years. And I asked the guards, like, what would happen, we say, if he went to England? And they said he would be, we would have to go get him and he would be extradited back and he would be put back in jail because it's such a serious crime. They said, look, if it's the shoplifter or whatever and they go off to England, if they're on a year's probation, we leave them off. You know, it's not worth the hassle of getting them back. But when it's a crime as serious as this, they would go and they would bring him back.
Mm.
And like, I'd rather if he was able to go away.
I think every one of us could absolutely understand that. And Una Ring, co-founder of Stalking Ireland, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
It's been an absolute pleasure and an honour to speak with you today. That is Una Ring, one of the co-founders of Stalking Ireland. And of course, she was sharing with us the beginning of the passage through the Senedd of a bill to make a specific crime of stalking.